Jane Levy, how are you?
Can you hear me?
I can hear
Cool, how are you?
you. Well, Jane, I have a bone to pick with you to start off.
Okay.
I read one of your books and I go buy the Busting Babes jersey. Then I read the Mantle book and I buy his minor league jersey. So you're costing me a lot of money with your books and buying jerseys.
Love the accent. I remember it's like being at home again. When I talk to people from New York, or I get back to New York, I start walking like New York. I start talking like New York, and then I think, fuck, I should have moved back to New York. But anyway,
You ready to
here I
rock and
am.
roll?
Yeah, I'm ready to rock and roll.
This is truly a pleasure. You're really one of my favorite authors, so to have you on is just like blowing my mind right now. So I really
Sorry
do
it's taken
appreciate
so
that.
long. I really apologize.
It's okay.
What cap are you wearing? Let me see.
Oh no, I think it's just a black Hollywood cap.
Okay, all
Nothing.
right.
Yeah, we'll leave it
Yeah.
off.
Oh no, you can wear your cap. No problem. I was just curious whether Mets, Yankees, Dodgers, Blue Jays, whatever.
Mets. My first wife actually left me because I was so obsessed with the Yankees. That's a God's honest truth. I have two Yankee seats from Yankee Stadium right here that my entire life, so.
One of my favorite stories that's true, actually, is that my father's father, who I never met because he died very young. I know this is not the glamour shot, but I'm just can't go sit back in the dining room again. Was a bookie and a rum runner, and he serviced the polo grounds. And in thanks for making sure everybody had what they needed, my father was appointed the water boy for the New York Football Giants in
Oh.
1927. Now, apparently, other things happened in 1927, but not in our house. That was the only thing that mattered.
Wow.
And when the Giants left with the Dodgers, God help them, my father was devastated, and he grew up on Coogan's Bluff, right, upper Manhattan, and 178th or 177th, something like that. And anyway, long story short, he becomes an entertainment lawyer. He was on the phone negotiating some kind of contract when he tripped and fell, broke his hip, ended up in the hospital, where he had to decide, given that he already had heart failure and cancer, whether he wanted to have this surgery or, just go home to die, basically. And he decides he's going to go have the surgery. And as they're wheeling him away, he literally, his last words to me on this planet were, "Oi, the Mets."
No.
Yep. It's true.
And the statement is still resonating today.
Oh boy, if he wasn't dead already, this would have killed him.
They would have killed him. All right, let's rock and roll. Have you ever
Okay.
seen anyone reading one of your books in public?
Yes.
Did you approach them the first time you saw it?
I think one of my relatives did.
Okay.
It was a I it was probably it was either Squeeze Play or Koufax. And I have to think about which it may have been Squeeze Play. My kids were pretty young. And
Okay.
we were at the Turks and Caicos, and there was a woman. No, it wouldn't, because it was a hardback. So I think I had to be Koufax. And I think one of my kids went up and said, "My mommy wrote that."
Oh, that's awesome.
I did see a woman reading Squeeze Play on a
Okay.
plane once, and I just listened to her talking to somebody else about it and how profane it was. I went, yeah, it is, right?
You mentioned my accent when you heard me, so you're a New York girl at heart. Where'd you grow up?
Long Island.
Did you have any New York hangouts? Did you come to the city a lot or not really?
Well, I ended up going to college at Columbia.
Okay,
So I
okay.
went to Barnard, actually, when they still had parietals, and you had to put your foot on the floor. If a guy came to visit in the parlor. Favorite hangouts, Central Park, honestly. I'm getting lots of beeps. I apologize. Is that you? Are you hearing them?
You're
They're not.
fine. It's all
Okay,
good.
good.
And after you make the move, what's one food from New York you miss the most? You're like, wow, I can't get what down here.
Pastrami.
That's an easy one, right?
And a good bagel. Bagels here are
Yes.
horrible. But my daughter is a pastry chef, and she
Oh.
can make a killer bagel.
So just the pastrami you're missing.
Yeah, brisket, a good brisket. I can make that. I can make the brisket. I've never made pastrami. I don't think I'm ever going to make pastrami. So let's leave it with pastrami.
My YouTube algorithm has all baseball stuff, obviously. And recently it was when Bush threw out the first pitch, and it was this ESPN short of him like prepping and stuff. You threw out the first pitch. How'd you prep for it?
I have a dog. Can you see her?
Yes.
Okay, she's asleep now. Her name is Betty Rue, because her father Chip came from down under to do the do. And her mother was the comportment champion of Texas, the best behaved dog in Texas. And I've got now the best behaved dog in Washington. So I have a house up in Cape Cod, where I spend a lot of time going to Cape Cod League baseball games, where Betty is a she takes infield practice with the guys at Eldridge Park. The team is called the Orleans Firebirds. It was the Cardinals until 2009, when Major League Baseball, in its infinite wisdom, told all the teams that had major league monikers, nicknames, the Cardinals, the Mets, the Reds, the Mariners, trying to forget who else there was. Anyway, they had to buy only and sell only major league made merch,
Amazing.
or they had to change their name. And the Red Sox obviously couldn't change their name. Because they were in Red Sox territory, that would have been, a kiss of death. And the Mariners didn't have to change their name because they preceded the Major League Mariners. But my Orleans Cardinals became the Firebirds. Betty takes infield practice. The manager slash coach throws for her and waters her down. And Betty doesn't, as he says, his name is Kelly Nicholson, nothing gets past her. So I have a house nearby with a very long deck, just about 60 feet. And I went to one end and I arrayed a bunch of chairs, reclining chairs at the other end, sort of like a fence, and threw to Betty 60 feet.
No.
Not, yes. That's how I did it. And then, and I was throwing. I was okay. I mean, of course, that was with one of the little orange chuck it balls. So then I come home and I called Koufax and I said, "What do I do?" And he says, "Whatever you do, don't go to the mound." And I went, "But I practiced
60 feet.
with the dog." He says, "Whatever you do, do not go to the mound." He said, "Everybody thinks they can go to the mound. It's a disaster. Don't do it." So I said, "Well, what should I do?" And he said, "Well," and before you could answer the question, I said, "Why don't you come up here? Here's my idea. You come here, you hide in the corner of the dugout. And when they call for me, I'll go, 'Oh, my
No.
elbow.' And you'll come strolling out and do it for me. It will be an instant bestseller." This is when the Babe Ruth book was published. And he said, "Forget about it," which is what he always says. And I was joking. I knew he wasn't going to do it. So I took his word. I went 30 feet, 40 feet, back to 30, 40, whatever. I'm like back, walking back and forth. And I threw what I like to describe as a curve that bounced in the dirt of the left-handed batter's box. My children say otherwise.
I'll go with
So
your
you have to
explanation.
go to the videotape.
It always sports reporter slash author or bust for you?
I sometimes when you write, you don't know what you're going to write. Or Joan Didion, I should say, who was a client of my father's. My father was an entertainment lawyer in New York. She was asked, "Why do I write?" And her answer was, "So I know what I think." And it's exactly the right answer. because you go like this and da, 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 and things come out. You go, oh, I didn't know I thought that, but apparently I do. So the other night I was watching, some game, and I was feeling I'd been feeling regretful, that I didn't do something more serious with my journalistic life. I should have written about climate change. I should have written about, I don't know, climate change is the one that keeps coming back to me. I could have done some good in the world, and all I've done is write around baseball. And then there was that game last night, the 18-inning World Series game, which, deployed moments of foolishness and wonderment, and a guy imitating Sandy Koufax, Japanese guy, going out to the bullpen to say, Yamamoto, I'll pitch. It's on 2 days rest. It's my side day anyway. And people made mistakes. Bichette getting picked off first base. The manager pitching to Ohtani at all.
Oh my.
And Clayton Kershaw, Sandy's guy, redeeming himself. I mean, I did not want him to go out with that last horrible playoff appearance. It was against the Phillies, right? This is sort of answering your question, where, where he was left in, hung out to dry is how it appeared to me. But maybe, he's such a stand-up guy that, maybe he had agreed to it, anyway, long story short, last night I thought, okay, maybe I didn't make a
Yeah,
mistake.
baseball's just so beautiful.
My maternal grandmother, who was a very feminine woman with rose sachet in her dresser and, a beautiful embroidered hanky in her décolletage, lived one long, loud foul ball from home plate at the original Yankee Stadium. And even though the apartment was facing the wrong direction, it was facing the Grand Concourse, and there's a park in between. She was on Walton Avenue, two blocks down. I imagined what was going on behind that wall. I was so young, I didn't really know what directions were, right? But there, if I leaned out her window by the fire escape on 158th Street, I could just hear the roar of the crowd. I mean, you're a New York guy. You know this, the side streets, especially if it's coming off the river, a river, the wind carries the sound. So I could hear occasional ball meeting bat. I could always hear the roar of the crowd that would bounce off the, there weren't tenements, they were apartment buildings. And they were built, the ones right there, in 1927 in honor of the Babe. That's when that neighborhood started to get developed. So I could hear the roar of the crowd, and occasionally I could hear the echo of Bob Shepard's voice. And I think that was the beginning of it. I think that was the beginning of, I want to know about this. I want to be in there. What's the big deal? What's going on? But I don't think it was just the beginning of baseball fascination. It was the beginning of, reportorial fascination. I got to get some answers here, man. It's like, what the hell is going on? Why are people yelling so much? And she was the person who took me. I have this across the room. I could go get it and show it to you. Who took me downtown, got me all dressed up, and I always had a problem when I, had to get fancy, with the white tights and, nice dress and Mary Jane's patent leather, Mary Jane shoes. Took me to Saks Fifth Avenue to buy a baseball glove. Now, she didn't know that Saks Fifth Avenue didn't deal in sporting goods. What she did know is that they had the best of everything. So if you wanted to get the best of everything, which is what she wanted for
You go
me,
to sex.
and then the rest of her grandchildren. I was one of seven. You go to Saks. So we go there, and it's right around opening day. And I was four or five, I think five, but I can't ask her, for she's gone. And there's a mannequin right by the front door of Saks, opposite Rockefeller Center, you know. And she's got a Yankee jersey on. I can still see her, you know, and a baseball glove on her left hand. And so my grandmother marches through the door and corrals the first, you know, salesman she can find, who looked like Mr. Whipple, and says, "I'll have that for my granddaughter." And Mr. Whipple said, "Madam, it's not for sale." And my grandmother said, "I'll have that for my granddaughter." So I went home with the worst baseball glove that's ever been seen. And I tried to use it, but it was horrible. It's a Sammy Esposito glove. How a Sammy Esposito glove, you know, I mean, he was playing for the White Sox at the time. How that ended up in Saks Fifth Avenue front window, God only knows. And this, you know, and my mother ultimately threw it out, you know, which was along with the baseball cards. And when I was at the Washington Post, where I started covering, you know, going on the road and covering baseball, one day on opening day, since it was always hard to find an opening day story in Washington, D.C., where there was no baseball, they say there's baseball now, but I'm not quite sure. So I called Sammy Esposito, and I found him. He was had been an assistant basketball coach, apparently was a very good basketball player at North Carolina State. He was an assistant to Jimmy V, and he had become assistant athletic director. And the first I tell him this story, the first thing he says, "Do you still have it?" I'm like, and I go, "No, my mother threw it out." And he goes, "Huh." And it turns out he had loaned his to David Thompson, the basketball
Of
player,
course.
who loaned it to Monty Tau, the shrimpy basketball player, for a softball game, and never got it back.
Wow, what a story.
Yeah.
You
These things
mentioned.
happen to me. I don't know why.
We're going to talk about your new book. I have one more fanboy question because you mentioned the Washington Post and you covered the Olympics, but you also cover non-sports. So give me your biggest story, either the biggest Olympic story you remember or your biggest non-sports story that you remember.
I have to remember the name. Hold on. God, one of Reagan's national security advisors, Robert. Oh, you can't tell a story without remembering the guy's name. He tried to kill himself. It was a big story. It was during Iran-Contra, and I was going to talk to him, and I went to Bob Woodward for advice on how to, you know, conduct that interview. And he gave me a hint that the guy was a student of Japanese culture, and particularly military culture, and that he said, "Find out if he was thinking about seppuku, meaning, you know, an honorary, not an honorary, an honorable death, you know, the way Japanese warriors have done for centuries." And so I asked the question, and I got the answer. And Robert McFarland, thank you, thank you. And that was probably the most important story. Back before anybody realized that AAU sports, as it used to be called, amateur sports, were corrupt, and that there was under the table payments. I broke the story that of what the under the table payments were at the Boston Marathon. So that got me an A1, you know, front page story. Most important Olympic story. There's, you know, the images are. I was in Los Angeles when, oh gosh, Mary, this is not important. Mary Decker, tripped over Zola Bud. I was, oh man, what? I was in Sarajevo, for the hockey game, the US-Russia hockey game.
Wow.
And this will sound really weird. Torvald and Dean. And the Press Village later became as like a grouping of brutalist concrete buildings with little cells. Later became part, whenever you looked at sniper footage, whenever they ran sniper footage during the war that overtook Sarajevo and so much part of the rest of the country, that's the footage they showed. Because those press buildings, were shot up and bombed and this and that. And anyway, so Torval and Dean, who were the pairs, not it was the dance competition, which of course, and they skated to Bolero. Dun 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 dun, dun, dun. And it was beautiful. And I would ordinarily have said, that's not sports. But it was fabulous and dramatic and sexy. And, go forward. And the seats that I was sitting on and that my colleagues were sitting on, that's what they used for to make the coffins that they placed in the out on the field where the opening ceremony took place.
Oh my God. All right, we're going to try to transition that to someone got a new book out. Make me commissioner. I know what's wrong with baseball and how to fix it. Congratulations. I know the
Thank you.
blood, sweat, and tears. I have so many authors on that goes into a book. And when you finally hit send the final time and the relief and the monkey off your back. So congratulations on finishing the book.
It was supposed to be the easy one. I mean, Sandy took about 4 years. Iggy, I think, took 5 years. God damn, the Babe took 8 years, way more than it took to write War and Peace. And that was pretty embarrassing. And this, I thought, it was precipitated by a breakfast at the Otisaga Hotel in Cooperstown on the day that Mariano Rivera was inducted into the Hall of Fame unanimously. Ichiro should have been unanimous, but he wasn't. I think maybe Shohei will be.
I think so, maybe. The rate he's going, he might be.
Maybe. I think so. If he lives that long. He's probably going to have to take the mound tonight with an IV in his
Yeah, oh
arm.
my God.
It was Tori was there with his wife, and Sandy was there with his wife, and I was there, and I'm like, they're talking about modern day baseball, and Sandy says something to the effect of, "Yeah, but the pitchers don't know where the ball's going half the time," which is true. And Joe says, "Yeah, and that means the hitters have to," and he pretends he's holding a bat. It's sort of like they were talking like in baseball tongues. And I remember both these guys are from Brooklyn. They were not exactly contemporaries, and they didn't go to the same school. But you're a New York guy. You know the word ginks? Yeah, okay, they're ginks. Do I have to explain that? No, okay, so they're ginks. And Tori's going, yeah, and then because of that, the hitters have to lean all the way across. Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, the etiquette there is you don't ask for autographs, you don't take notes, and you don't record anything. So I wasn't, and I couldn't follow what they were saying. But it's like they've explained it. It's like, wow. And then Joe says, hard to watch. And Sandy says, I don't watch. That was the genesis for this book. Because I thought, how is it possible that of these people sitting here, I'm the one watching games on game day under the table during dinner parties, even ones that I host? And so it's like, so I set out to find out what happened. What happened to baseball? How did baseball lose America? And then, of course, there was COVID, and we lost a lot more than baseball. We lost, God knows how many lives, and a sense of security that I don't sure we'll ever get back. And so it comes around to 2021, and you probably remember this, baseball guy that you are, that, you know, the headlines that dominated the offseason were baseball's broken, baseball's dead, baseball's dying, baseball should be federalized. Mm-hmm. I have to say that's one thing I don't agree with. You know, it was, so I thought, okay, I'll tell this story. That's what I'll do.
Mm-hmm.
And then they appointed Theo, you know, who I refer to as the czar of making baseball fun again.
Yes.
Now, of course, I'm speaking of Theo Epstein.
Of course.
And it took them 2 years of testing at various levels to, you know, to show the viewing public what they were to get preview, what they were planning to do and to try to get it right, meaning, of course, the pitch clock, mm-hmm. the bigger bases, banning the shift. You have to keep your feet on the dirt, you know, on the side of the base that you were supposed to be playing, the disengagement rule, mm-hmm. thereby negating the advantage of anybody who had a pickoff move, right?
Yeah.
And also, you know, the pitch clock, as it turns out, you probably know this, mm-hmm. was already on the books, just nobody had ever enforced it.
Yeah.
So
now we got the clock there too.
It's
supposed to be a real rule, yeah.
It was, and mm-hmm. But they didn't bother either. They didn't know it, or they just
said, they didn't know it.
So, you know, so that changed the trajectory of what was going to happen, and therefore I had to change the book. I had to throw out almost 2 years of work and start all over. And I went, you know, to every level of baseball I could find, beginning in January 2023, and followed it to see how the rules were working and how well they were working, what they didn't do, and what else needed to be done. And then Rob Manfred announced, by the way, you know, I'm gonna retire after my term is up in 2029. So therefore, I thought, well, okay, you know, the office is gonna be open. Why not me? Thus, make me commissioner. I know what's wrong with baseball and how to fix it. I have to say that after last night's 18-inning game, World Series game, in which virtually everything happened, I would say that everybody should know the right things that happen in baseball and why, and so many of them were on display last night. So I know what's right with it. And that's what makes it so important to fix what's still wrong with it. And so that's part of the book, but also trying to explain the sequence of events, most of which are independent of baseball. You know, I mean, they didn't develop the IBM computer in 1951, you know, because Elston Howard was going to become a Yankee later in the decade. That was not the reason for UNIVAC. You know, the human mind is restless and seems to have a great desire to put itself out of business. And baseball took up the cudgel before anybody else, thanks to the numbers that they'd been collecting since Chadwick invented the scoring system in 1878, I think. I got maybe off by a year or so. And had the advantage over, you know, other industries, and made it visible to people. They could understand what was going on if you looked at baseball, right? And it set off this, you know, feeding frenzy of analytic development and thought. And, you know, I would say the most important part of the book, the most serious, is I have a new friend named Pekko Hosoi, who is the creator, co-creator of the MIT Sports Analytics Lab. And they worked for Major League Baseball. They worked for FIFA. They, you know, the NBA, blah, 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 you know, doing academic kind of research to develop products and answers to questions of things that are going on in the field. And She said the thing about baseball now is it's the canary in the coal mine. It's showing us what you just look out on the field and you can see in action the effect of AI and of computerization, optimization, all those ization words that I hate. The drive for efficiency that numerically, has altered the game and the way it's played and how you structure a lineup, no more flappy guys batting number two. And she said, but the other thing about it is, so the algorithms that have been developed and which dictate much of the way rosters are constructed, lineups are constructed, she said, the guys who create that stuff, and they are very, very male, they're brilliant, and the findings are irrefutable. The case is airtight, and they're not going away. She said the problem is not the information. The problem is that the people developing those formulas don't have what in data science is called domain knowledge. In other words, you don't know what you're talking about. You may know the numbers, but you don't know how it's going to play out on the field because you've never been to a baseball game.
Yes, so true.
So she said, and she said that that's the thing that's most concerning. They don't understand where and why you can't apply it, and why the final judgment about when to abide by what a computer tells you must be from a human being who knows both, who's been given the information by all those baseball ops guys. I mean, Jim Palmer told me that the Orioles have one person, a female person. He called her a girl, and I won't go there with Jim. She's betraying his age. One girl whose whole job is to decide when to bring the infield in. I would say that I might go with Dusty Baker on that. I only mentioned Dusty because he was the most human in the game, as far as I was concerned, who I talked to at great length in 2023. And he I said, what happened to empiricism in in baseball? And he goes, I can't repeat. I mean, it was baseball talk. But he said, when them little punk guys upstairs come down and tell me that my eyes don't know what they're seeing, and my eyes are lying to me, no. Wisdom and experience are derided in this country. They don't matter anymore. The only science that isn't questioned is data science.
I know, I know.
And so, if you look at baseball in this context, you can see, this is what Pecco is saying, you can see what's going on in all the industries. You can figure out why they know what ads to send you, why what you know what your insurance rates have zoomed up. Why? There's an algorithm, boys and girls. They know everything about you. And I think it's a real warning to us never to relinquish what the players now call the human element.
Yeah, of course. Did you enjoy writing this book? Because it was definitely way different than one of your books where you're doing research, sitting, you still sat down with the players, but you delved into different topics of it instead of just focusing on the Babe or Mickey or Sandy. Did you like doing this kind of book?
The traveling and the meeting all these guys, I met some wonderful baseball guys. I mean, Scott Hatterberg, Hattie is just, yeah. I mean, again, you're New York. You know what the word mensch means.
Yes, of course.
You don't need, and maybe outside New York, you don't know. Mensch in Yiddish means a whole person. And there's no greater compliment. Hattie is the best. And his story of how he went from the sore arm catcher to patient X, as he refers to himself, in the Moneyball revolution, the guy that Billy Beane went and got, even though he couldn't play his position anymore, and blessed Ron Washington taught how to play first base and had, you know, they calculated at the end of that season, I think it was 2002 or 2003, that because he got on base at such a high percentage, that if they had had 9 Scott Hatterbergs in their lineup all year long, they would have scored more runs than the New York Yankees.
Unreal.
So, and what does he become? And he hates analytics. He's a scout. He became a scout for the, and for whom? Whatever they're called now, A's.
Sacramento, who knows where they even play at this point. You did some crazy road trips all over the states, small town, big town. What fascinated you, what really like opened your mind? Like, wow, I'm in this small town or I'm here about baseball. Like, what really opened your eyes? Like, wow, I had no idea about that.
Well, I can give you two opposite stories.
Please
One
do.
Is I went to the MIT Sports Analytics Conference, okay. which is an annual event, and it's kind of like a star fucker in data science event, and attended by at a big ticket, $1,000 for anybody to come, and a lot of students come, and you know it's out of a lot of students, you know, reach, because it's so expensive, and they have seminars and they have fancy people come and give lectures, and I went the year that Bill James and Morgan Sword, he's the executive vice president in MLB for baseball operations. He came to report on the early findings of the pitch clock, which proved to be completely prescient. I mean, they were almost exactly what they were at the end of the season in terms of how much time was shaved off each game. But it was dominated by people from the gambling industry. In the gaming industry. And I just went, oh boy, you know. And also they had very meaningful panel discussions, one of which was on how to create. There's Miss Betty. She's letting you know she's here. Hi, Miss Betty. How to create fans in this world of science and data, right? And you know what their conclusion was? After all that research and algorithms and, you know, interviewing and polling and this thing and that thing, you know, and inventing a language for marketing that just is like, ugh, talk like a human being, please. The way to create a fan in this environment and this market is to go to a live event with somebody you love.
Really?
Duh. It's like, oh, really? They had to do a lot of research?
Really?
Yeah, really. On the other hand, I went to Driveline, which is, you know, considered the, I mean, Kyle Bode, who had created it in 2008, you know, using the Pitch FX data that was let loose on the world because they didn't protect, Major League Baseball didn't protect the URL, thus sponsoring a generation of data geeks to go to work on what's known as a tranche of data. You know, these are the people now running baseball. You know, but I met there a guy I adore and who I think has contributed enormously. His name is Jason Ochart. He runs the minor league hitting system for the Boston Red Sox. He, you know, he worked a lot with Roman Anthony in the last couple of years. And he created a hitting program to be the antidote to the Driveline throwing program. Now that they've got everybody throwing 100 miles an hour and, you know, tearing their elbows up, you know, how do you handle this? What's the answer? And he uses technology to make games to help guys, learn to swing the way they need to swing in order to hit this filthy stuff that they're facing every day. You know, I can't think of anybody I like better in this world than Jason. I adore him. I asked him if he would marry my daughter. so, you know, they're not all bad guys. And that's a really good example And I'm having a momentary brain lock, but like McFarlane, it'll come to me. There's a system of basically teaching guys how to do things without, in baseball, without dogmatically showing them. So, instead of saying, I want you to turn your hips out this much at this point, or not turn your hips this way, they create exercises that compel you within your body to find the solution to the problem they create. So, and he learned
Interesting.
it basically in college when he was taking courses in kinesthesiology and stuff. How do you teach somebody who's lost the ability to walk again? You can't, it doesn't help somebody to be saying, well, put your foot here, put your foot there, you give them tasks that they have to meet, and let them. The phrase is self-organize your body to do what it needs to do to hit a ball. The other way, 300 feet. It's brilliant, and he created that hitting system. And what can I say?
I hate that it makes sense, you know?
It makes complete sense. And so when people tell me, oh, she hates analytics, I don't hate analytics. I hate that no one saw what was happening and said, wait a minute, we have to be in charge of the analytics, not the analytics being in charge of us.
You mentioned the pitch is thrown 100. Every pitch is now thrown 100. Every time Skeens pitches, the next day I go on ESPN, I'm like, oh, please don't say he's hurt. And it's weird. Like, that's how you watch football. After every play, you look down the corner. Was there a flag on the play? Every time a big pitcher pitches now, 101, all this stuff, all I worry about is pitchers getting hurt. For me, that's one of the biggest issues with baseball right now. It's like, it's scary, isn't it?
It's probably the biggest issue.
Yes.
And to their credit, Major League Baseball put out a report, not that they didn't make it public, but it was public to reporters last December, in which, it was actually, they didn't, it wasn't prescriptive. They didn't say what needs to happen, but they did do a pretty good description. And last year, 2024, they spent $1 billion of talent sitting on the injured list, right?
Oh my God.
And of that 1 billion, two-thirds of that was because of pitching injuries. So
Wow.
this is a scourge. And it's not only unhealthy for the players whose elbows are coming apart, but it's unhealthy for the game. And this may be too subtle an argument to be made. People have looked at me and go, oh, nobody had. Baseball was a game that has lent itself to writing and to storytelling forever, and every story has ingredients. It has instances and scenes and this and numbers and this and that and the next thing. Well, baseball was held together by matchups, by being able to go and see Clayton Kershaw and Bumgarner face each other 11 times between 2000 and I think 2013 was the last one, but I could be wrong. 11 times, or Koufax, pitch trying to get Henry Aaron out, which he never could, right? And these matchups, whether it was ace against ace or ace against one of the greatest hitters ever in baseball, were the glue that held together seasons and series and decades, and they're gone. They're just gone because the average length of a start this year was 5.2 innings. And you can't have those matchups and then have, when that, I haven't checked this yet because I did it for every other year, how many no-hitters were stopped, in progress. But I can't begin to count the number that were stopped in, as of I think 2023, more than a quarter of all no hitters were sabotaged by managers or analytic guys. We're in the last 3 years. So it's some crazy statistic like that. Do you think you're ever going to see another perfect game?
I know.
Well, there are some hopeful signs. Dave Roberts, the Grim Reaper, who pulled Kershaw out of his perfect game in 2022 and pulled Rich Hill out of one in 2015, I think. Gonsolin, out of a one hitter. And who's the other guy? Stripling. And has to answer to his bosses. What happens if they get injured, right? Because he's pushed him a little farther. He let Yamamoto come out for the ninth inning
Yes.
in Baltimore in one of the greatest games of the regular season. He was pitching a no-hitter and he let him come out and try to complete it. When Kershaw was pulled, and that was in April 2022, Bill the Spaceman Lee called me in tears. And I said, "Spaceman, why are you crying?" And he said, "Because the guy wasn't allowed to find out how good he could be."
Wow, that's
Well,
powerful.
yeah, and after in you know the denouement was that so he comes out for the ninth inning. Yamamoto comes out for the
Gives up
ninth
the home
inning.
run.
He gives up a wall scraper home run to Jackson Holliday. Nobody could bring that one back because of the way, where it was hit at Camden Yards. And he loses the game and he loses, the
He
no-hitter.
gives 5 runs or something, right?
No, I mean, he was pulled out. He was pulled after 8 2/3 innings, He'd gotten the first 2 outs already. But they lost the game on that home run. And so everybody's going, "Oh, it's so terrible." I'm like, "No, it was perfect for baseball.
Exactly what we needed.
It's exactly what we needed." And Yamamoto's complete game the other night, and his willingness to go down to the bullpen last night
That's
and
bulldog
say,
stuff right there.
"Yeah, that's old-fashioned stuff." And then go clean up the dugout
Oh,
because
just
people in Japan are
the
cleaner than we
greatest, the
are.
greatest.
Yeah. Maybe it was born of the fact that their bullpen was completely unreliable until they discovered Will Klein last night. For whatever reason, starting pitchers have been going longer since that September game. And I like to take credit for it because I was sitting in the dugout giving Davey shit about what he did to Kershaw.
We keep bringing up the Dodgers, obviously, and Koufax you bring up. Were you nervous about doing a book on him, knowing he wasn't an interview kind of guy? Like, that's a real ballsy move by you to start to pick Koufax. Because I've only heard story. My grandfather would tell me he was a Dodger fan. Koufax, I would hear it. I'm like, okay, I get it. He was great. So obviously, I read your book twice, and I was always like, wow, she went all in with him. And he's like not a big interview guy. That wasn't intimidating for you?
I gotta break it to you gently.
Yeah.
Authors often are given ideas. And
Okay.
that was one. A friend of mine who'd been a Daily News columnist, Dave Hershey, had gone into book publishing and he asked me to write it.
Oh,
And
okay.
my first reaction was, no. I still hate him for what he did to Mickey in 1963. And I was. It was pointed out to me that I was enough of a grown-up to get over that. And I never expected to be able to reach him because I knew the same reputation that you knew, that he was elusive and enigmatic and, all those E words. But so I never expected to hear from him. And what I ended up doing was writing a letter. And I gave it to Don Fear, who was then the head of the Players Association, and to Fred Wilpon, who was his old friend from the playground in Brooklyn, a gink, right? And said, "Would you please forward this to him?" And one day I'm sitting here, there's Betty the dog. "Oh, I haven't fed you yet, Betty." Gosh, sorry. And the phone rings, and it, voice says, "Hi, Ms. Levy, and he said it right?
Okay.
He says, this is Sandy. And then there's this pause, and he remembers to say Koufax. Is it, he's on a first name basis with the universe. And he said, I don't really have any interest in your book. and I went, I started talking. Have I shut up yet? Right? Have I let you get a word in edgewise? I didn't let him get a word in edgewise for an hour more. I just kept talking. And the more I talked, the more I realized what a polite, well-raised young man he was. I mean, he has manners. And so he wouldn't interrupt me. And I just kept talking. I told him about my children. I told him about my Sammy Esposito glove. You name it. I told him everything. And at the end of it, when I finally took a breath, he said, well, I still don't have any
No.
interest in your project, but if you want to come down to Vero Beach and talk about it, that would be okay. And I went,
Wow.
Hosanna. And he did not cooperate with this book. He calls it an unauthorized biography by a very neat lady. Put it on my tombstone if I have one. And it's all right in the front of the book, what he was willing to do and what he wasn't. I think it's essential. Oh, there she is. Betty, say hi. Betty. Betty. Mike, say hi to Betty. Say,
Betty, the
Betty.
rough, most
Betty.
well-behaved dog.
Yep. She hears somebody outside. I think you have to always level with your readers. So what I did is I recouped, not recouped, I restated that whole story and, and said to readers, this is what he was willing to do. He was willing to tell friends of his, teammates, who otherwise would never have spoken to me because they, well knew his reputation. He said, they can call me and I'll tell them that it's okay to talk to you. And he also agreed to answer any questions of fact. So, for example, from a reporter's point of view, this is gold because, his birth father, Jack Braun, left the family when Sandy was three, and his mother remarried a local, a neighborhood lawyer named Irving Koufax, and Sandy took his name. Well, as a writer, you have to find out, was he legally adopted? Right? My children are adopted, so it would be a question I particularly would want to ask. And let me just say, if I had to figure that out on my own, I would have been a year in the Brooklyn Hall of Records, right? Particularly before they were all digitized. But instead, I could go and say, were you legally adopted by Irving? No, I was not, but he is my father. And that's it. And Sandy's other reputation, aside from the inaccurate one that he's standoffish and all that stuff, is for being incredibly honest. You can trust what this man has to say. So if he says, I wasn't, then that's but Irving was my father, and da 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 it's go with God, it's good.
It always makes me laugh because you hear about, and you just keep saying it, he was a gentleman, he was this, and then you go to the Mick, who maybe wasn't the biggest gentleman. What a transition to go from that to the last boy with Mickey Mantle. Like, it's that's a weird transition, right?
Yeah, it was. And it was particularly hard for me because, growing up in New York, as you know, either you were a Willie guy or a Duke
Duke
guy
guy.
or a Mickey guy. I was a Mickey guy. Here's this, I've been told this is TMI, but I'm going to tell you anyway.
Please
I
do.
was conceived the day that Mick hit his first major league home run in Comiskey Park. I was born a mile north of Yankee Stadium in a hotel, a hotel, sorry, in a hospital that no longer exists. And I was very premature. My father, much to my consternation, I loved him dearly, but he described me at birth as looking like a raw plucked chicken. And I'm like, Dad, that's just not good for the self image. And I identified with Mickey because of Mickey's frailties, because of the osteomyelitis that he had when he came to the major leagues. Because now I've had three knee replacements, so I really identify with him now. Because Joe DiMaggio ran him off that ball in right center field in Game 3 of the 1951 World Series, and 2 months before I was born. And and Mickey stepped in a divot left by a groundskeeper. This is what I'm talking about, the human element, right? Who had forgotten to put the top over the drain in right center field that day, forgot to put it on. And so Mickey is running because Casey said, go for anything.
Every ball, go for.
And his leg goes into his spike goes into that hole, and he told me that it felt like the knee went through the front of his leg. I mean, he tore everything. He tore everything. They couldn't diagnose it, much less fix it. And he played 18 years, wondering what he could have been had he been the whole Mickey Mantle that, Casey saw in spring training that year. And people say to me they're so different, Sandy and Mickey, but you know what? As teammates, as guys who showed up,
A great teammate.
people who played hurt and didn't bitch about it, they were very much alike.
What was it about Mantle? I've asked this to people I met, my dad, Mike Francesa, Bob Costas, even his eulogy. I wrote down, it's like he was our guy. When he was hot, we felt great. When he slumped or got hurt, we sagged. How did an entire generation of men idolize him? Like, why? Because, like, to this level, maybe Jordan, but like, the way my dad and you hear Francesa, you can't talk about Mantle ever. Walk on water. Why was that? What was it about him?
I think, Mike, if you look at the picture on the front of the book, which it took me months to find, I actually have it here. You want me to get it?
Oh, I have the book here.
Okay. Well, you see how he looks beautiful and unruined. It was before, really, he started drinking a lot. This is post-war America, right? It's that time where we think we can do anything. We're rebuilding. We had beat the Japs. We beat the Nazis. And now we're rebuilding Europe with a Marshall Plan. There was an optimism, a post-war optimism. We're making consumer goods that women who are now going to go out of the workplace because they don't need to work anymore because the men are home. Mickey in. Captured in his smile and his beautiful, Oklahoma face, that sense of post-war optimism. And I think that has a lot to do with it. He certainly had the skills to do everything. He was allowed to get away with everything. I think there's a certain quotient of men who envy that. But it didn't do Mickey any good. Mickey needed to be told right up front by somebody, you can't talk like that.
Knock it off, yeah.
Knock it off. I did it when I met him in 1983. I don't think he was a mean guy. I think he was a really bad drunk. He came of age in the middle of America when Bill W. and the idea of Alcoholics Anonymous was just getting its legs. Nobody knew, that it was a hereditary disease. Nobody knew, that the fact that all his aunts and uncles had it too was a tip-off that having every New Yorker want to buy him around, was not a kindness. The 50s were, cafe society and the capital of baseball. And he was beautiful to watch. Doesn't mean Willie Mays wasn't. Willie Mays was a far better fielder, but he had There was always that what if? What if he hadn't been injured? You would, and what's he gonna do? Is he gonna collapse in the baseline? I saw him collapse in the baseline in a May 18th game against the Twins, batting right-handed, and he hits a ball. It's a 4-3 game, and he hits a ball to Versailles, who bobbles it, who rarely bobbled anything. And he reaches for a gear of speed that he no longer has. Meaningless May game. And he pulls the adductor muscle off the bone. It was the year after Maris taught, eclipses to the extent one can, Babe Ruth. And Mickey was off to the best start he'd had since 56 or 57. And boom, there it is again. I don't think he was ever really the same. And then he comes back in 63 and he catches the spike in the cyclone fence at Memorial Stadium in Baltimore. Something was always tripping him up one way or another.
I have a million mental questions, but I have to go back to your book, Make Me Commissioner. I Know What's Wrong with Baseball and How to Fix It. We talked about data, we talked about pitching. Something you brought up in the book, besides letting children under 10 in the stadium, which is the greatest idea ever, and it should be locked in to bring more kids into the game. The black athlete, one of my closest friends, lives in Virginia. And this morning we talked, I made my notes about our podcast, and his sons play baseball, 9 and 6. And we were just talking and stuff. Sends me a picture of the team, and he lives in a mixed neighborhood. He's like, they're the only two black kids in the league. He said, Mike, none of them play anymore. Why is that? And why are they going to other sports now? Because Griff, we can go on and on forever, but there's no superstar black players anymore. That's weird.
Well, it's really funny. Well, I don't know if funny is the right word. I was having this conversation with a guy named Darwin Penny, who is, oh shit, don't brag. Sorry. My friend Alex Adelman, the comic, who's
Okay.
fabulous, is sitting with my friend Janet Marie Smith at Dodger Stadium.
That's some flex right now.
Yeah, really. Okay, so. What was I trying to answer? Oh, I was talking to Darwin Penny and about this because it's a heartache. Major League Baseball has sat on its laurels, every year with the April 15th Jackie Robinson anniversary, while watching the percentage of black players decline from 18.7% down to this year at 6.2%. People forget that it was Ken Griffey who taught guys like you to wear your hat backwards.
It was the
It's not
coolest
a
guy.
white guy who did it. It
Never
was a
it
black guy.
Camden Yards when he had the home run derby with the backwards hat, being aware, it was the coolest thing I've ever seen in my life.
And I got to tell you, as a mother of a white kid who loved everything baseball, black guys were cool. They still are. They were the cool guys. I'm going to be like that. And the problem is that the demographics have changed. Baseball has become a country club sport, which is what Darwin Penny said to me. It costs more now because of the way you have to progress. You can't become a major leaguer because you played little league anymore. You have to play club baseball and travel baseball and go to perfect game events or ones
Perfect, yes.
sponsored by an equal kind of, these industries that bring huge numbers of kids together and they give them showcases to play, and play tournament games with kids they've never met before. So teamwork, forget it, doesn't matter. It's very expensive. It's up. Oh, I'm sorry about that. I think I stepped on something and let the sound in. No, it's off again. Sorry. It became too expensive. And whereas in any small location, you could hang a hoop, right? In an alley in Manhattan, a rat-infested alley in Manhattan, you can do that. And it's easier to get, play 3-on-3 than it is to try to get a team. Other sports have made themselves more available to young kids.
Yes.
Smaller fields, you know, smaller teams, blah, blah, blah. But this was a way, this is one of the ways in which Major League Baseball just let it happen. Laissez-faire management, just let it happen. And the kind of baseball that Ken Griffey and Tim Raines and Ricky Henderson played and what they brought to the game, both with, you know, extra speed and daring and personality, you know. I love when Ricky talks about himself in the third person. I love it. You know, these guys were incandescent. And baseball became, in the analytic age, you know, we all talk about how they were slow guys playing second base. They were, you know, the extra outfielder became a second baseman because all you really wanted him for was to slug and everybody was going to hit the ball over his head anyway. So what difference did it make? So the speed and the value of it diminished because analytics said it's not worth taking the risk to steal a base. So the things that previous players, previous black players brought to the game were no longer valued as much.
Oh.
And at the same time, it was becoming more expensive to play. And so they lost a whole, not just generation, two generations,
yeah.
three generations of potential black talent. My proposal for this, since I think I told you my grandfather, who I never met, was a bookie and a rum runner. So this is not moralistic on my part, you know, not that I ever met him. Is dead at age 450 something, so way before I was born. Take the money, the profits they're making from gambling, you know, the $1 billion that they were promised they would make. Take it and build Jackie Robinson training complexes in every major league city. Give those kids the same advantages, equipment, coaching, teaching, meals that they give kids in the Dominican Republic.
At those baseball factories, they have all, yes.
Why not here? Why not give? And it isn't. It wouldn't be just black kids. It'd be black kids and, you know, American-born black kids. And it might be, you know, immigrants who came here and want to learn how to play and didn't at home from Ethiopia or wherever. Or it'd be Hispanic kids, whoever. Or, you know, poor white kids. There's plenty of them, too. Just give them the chance to learn the skills and to fall in love with it, which is why all kids under the age of 10, accompanied by a sober adult, get in free when I become commissioner.
I've had you on for over an hour. I have a million Babe Ruth questions. We're going to save that to next time we do it because I always thought Lee Montfield's book was like the book on Babe Ruth. And then I read yours and it just gave the most different perspective ever. It was amazing. So when we do this in person at a private bar in New York, I'll ask the Ruth questions.
No, I'll come back and do it on another. I would love to talk about him.
I'm obsessed with him. So there were so many questions, but I don't want to hold up you too long. So.
No, it's okay. Let me just say this one thing.
Please do.
I didn't want to write that book. And remember I said it took 8 years.
8 years, yes.
And I didn't want to do it because I didn't think I was going to be able to find anything new.
Different, yeah.
Lee,
that's
Lee
a ballsy move. Yes.
Lee couldn't find anything new. He's a fabulous writer. He's a friend. You know, all sorts of things that I like. But where were you know, everybody who knew him, virtually except for his, you know, daughter Julia, was dead by the time Lee and I came around. What changed it for me, the advantage I had that I didn't realize I was going to have, was that by the time I came along, huge amounts of family documents and archives had been digitized.
Okay.
So Bob Kramer, who came before Lee, and then Lee couldn't go to the archives of the Baltimore Sun, for example, and type in George H. You know, Ruth Sr. And find out that the Baltimore Sun carried little stories about how he divorced his wife. I could.
Okay.
They couldn't
okay.
go to the, you know, Maryland State Archives and dig out, you know, a gigantic trove of legal documents, arrest records on how George had Kate Ruth arrested when he found her in a compromised position with his bartender. So this is a way in which technology really has facilitated my business. And it made the whole babe thing a lot longer. I like to say I spent more time with him than either of his wives put together.
We are going to rock and roll with Babe Ruth next time. Ready to finish up with five quick hit questions.
Okay.
Coolest person in your phone that if you texted them, they would text you right back.
Sandy.
Yeah, that's such a good answer. God damn it. One sporting event in history you wish you can witness live. Front row seat to any sporting event in the history of the world. Where are you sitting?
Sandy's perfect game.
That's okay. That's a really, really good one. Favorite show to binge watch?
Oh, The Diplomat.
Coolest piece of memorabilia that you own?
The sweater Mickey Mantle took off his back and gave to me on a windy, rainy day in a golf course at Atlantic City. Because he said, somebody give that girl a sweater. She's going to fucking freeze. And nobody had a sweater, so he gave me his. And I hung it on the door facing my computer while I was writing because I wanted to remember that Mickey Mantle was not just the mean, compromised alcoholic that that people saw at the end in the last years of his life. You know, I don't think he was a mean guy at all. And I think there was a decent guy, you know, aching to get out.
And then the final one, one player you thought was going to be special, but for one reason or another, didn't happen.
Jerry Cooney.
Jerry Cooney comes on here all the time. The boxer, Jerry Cooney, though.
Jerry Cooney. I sat with him in one of the old hotels in the Catskills while some Spanish-speaking lovely took, you know, clothespins and put them on his toes prior to a fight that ended up getting called off because he had an injury, but it was foot reflexology. I've never seen anybody get foot, you know, and that was some foot reflexology. I thought he would be a better fighter, but he turned out to just be another white punching bag.
The great white hope, yes. He comes on here all the time. He's the greatest. And how many times do people come up to you and say, oh, I have a suggestion for your next book? All the time?
Hasn't happened recently. And part of the reason is, I think, who are you going to write about?
I always wanted you to write about Josh Hamilton. I always wanted that. Or maybe, what about Griffey? Griffey, I don't know if he had too much, like, would it be that interesting? Josh Hamilton, I always, no?
I've already done a book about somebody's
their addiction. Okay.
And who accomplished a lot more than Josh Hamilton.
Very fair.
The publishing world is a horror show at the moment. Getting friends of mine who are great writers who've been able to make a living, you know, writing books and big magazine pieces, can't do it anymore. There's so few things being published and the money in it is so much less. They would laugh at you, go, Josh Hamilton, unless somebody found him dead in a sewer, then you might have a thing. Mm-hmm. Richard Ben Kramer, who did the Ultimate DiMaggio book, there's another one I'll never try to do over, you know, was working on an A-Rod book before he died and prematurely at a young age of lung cancer. And he was having a really hard time with it. People try to write life stories before the third act.
Yeah.
And, you know, who would have seen J-Lo coming, right? Who would have seen that? Or that he would end up, you know, on the TV set with Jeets.
With Jeets, with Jeter and Ortiz.
But you have to wait to the third act. And people are too impatient in this world. I mean, if you pick something that's finite by definition, you say, I'm only going to do that season in his life or something. Well, you know, it has to be a pretty good season to get a whole book out of it. But I think people try to do things prematurely, and I don't, I can't be accused of that.
Jane, this was an absolute blast. I hope I made it a little different. We're going to do part two about Babe Ruth and stuff. And the book is Make Me Commissioner. I Know What's Wrong with Baseball and How to Fix It. This was an honor. Go feed Betty. And thank you so much for this. And enjoy game four of the World Series.
Hanukkah's coming, everybody. Christmas is coming.
Jane, I will
Feed my
promote the
dog.
hell. Yes, I will promote the hell of the book and we'll talk soon, okay?
Okay, you be well.
Jane
Bye-bye.
Levy, thank you so
Thank
much.
you.
Bye-bye.